God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, you're the reason we're here. Is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Anybody? You can wave at the camera, raise your blue hand, unmute yourself. Seeing none. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have Katie P. tell her story. And after she finishes sharing, we'll take a short break at the top of the hour. We'll call for announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, and then we'll get to ask her some questions. So you will see a user called Questions in the chat. And as you think of questions that you may want to ask Katie, and feel free to chat those questions to the user Questions. So super excited to have Katie here tonight. I don't want to take up another minute of her time. I'd like to welcome Katie Parker.
Oh, thank you so much, David. Katie Parker, alcoholic. Great to be here. I got to show you guys something really exciting. Tomorrow, I am going to get this little puppy. Oh, I know it. I haven't had a dog in 17 years. Now, I've been hearing a lot of people say that these are the COVID dogs, and I've probably lost my mind. So I'll get back with you on how I'm doing with a puppy. I haven't had to nurture anything for a long, long time, other than my husband. And that's a whole nother story. Let me get my timer here going. I wanted to show y'all the dog. David, and most of you know that I missed this meeting. Out of all the Zoom meetings I've either been attendance of or been speaking at, I've only missed two, and David's was one of them. And I am so, so sorry. I just totally spaced it out. And, I found that, you know, following a Zoom meeting schedule was a little difficult. It wasn't easy to put in your phone because you needed the passwords, and I had a hard copy on my computer, and I had a software. Oh, I'm telling you, it was a mess. So, David, I apologize for that, and he gave me another shot at it, so thank you so much. I've been sober since October the 28th of 1984. I just celebrated a birthday a few days ago. I'm 36 years sober. It still blows me away when I say that. I got sober when I was 26. I'm 62 now. And I got to tell you something. I love getting older. Not everybody feels that way, but I love getting older. I mean, of course, the hair, the skin, you know, the eyes. Oh, those are all challenging. But what I have here and what I have here, I would never surrender. I mean, the level of maturity that I have or knowledge of life and experiences, I'd never want to give those up. And I'll tell you, I mean, I'm real clear that there's mortality there also, but I know I'm on the back nine. I just hope I'm not putting on the 18th hole tonight, you know? So, I mean, I just look at life a lot different because of mortality. You know, it's like, how do I want to live the last half of my life? And I'll tell you, thank God we're given this program. We are in some very challenging times. Don't let anybody fool you that these times are not challenging for everyone. Everyone is wrapped extra tight. And alcoholics are no different. As a matter of fact, we better be redoubling our efforts on everything, redoubling our efforts on prayer and meditation, on an evening review, on watching a 10th step. These are crucial things. I feel like this plant is just about to make me crazy. If my husband were here, he would, when he introduces me, he likes to say I'm a little bit like taking a drink out of a fire hose. I am a lot coming at you, and I won't argue with that. I am a lot coming at you, but I'm very clear. Today, I get to be the teacher. I love being the student, but today I'm the teacher, right? I'm telling you my story, my experience, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never want to sound like I'm an expert on this, but have I had my ass handed to me 8,000 times? Yes. So if that makes me an expert, well, put a check mark in that part of the box. You know, I'm real clear that I'm the vessel to help you get connected to the power. I'm not the power. I never want to be the power. I don't know what boy you should date, what car you should drive, what job you should take, but I can darn sure get you connected to the power, and the power can tell you what to do. I've been through so many different phases of Alcoholics Anonymous in 36 years. I love saying that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was named by the Library of Congress as one of the 88 books that shaped America. If you've never heard that, I hope it gave you goosebumps, because when I heard that, I was blown away. I say it a lot now. It never is lost on me, but I don't have the goosebumps every time. But something about that was, the first time I mentioned it, I was in front of about 2,500 people. And it was a pretty big deal, pretty big conference. And I said that, and I said, and my book sat on the shelf for 15 years, and there was a collective groan. Well, I didn't anticipate that. I went, oh, like your book hadn't sat on that shelf. Oh, come on. There's nobody in AA that's been nailing this. I've had people tell me they were, and I just being around them, I can tell they're not. They're already bugging the crap out of me in short order, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, it's human nature to slack. Our book says, in two places, our book says it's easy. What? It's easy to let up on this spiritual program, easy to rest on our laurels. Of course it is. We are by nature undisciplined people. My home group is the primary purpose group. It's in Austin, Texas on Tuesday nights at 2701 South Lamar at 7:30 Central Standard Time. If you're ever in Austin, we'd love to have you. It's a very interesting big book study. We study the book line by line, week after week. I know it doesn't sound as much fun as it is, but what we're doing that's a little different than most big book studies is we're studying what the founders found necessary to put in the big book, why'd they put it in there, and what point are they trying to get across. We ask you to stay out of your experience. Now, please don't hear me as anything's wrong with that. Matter of fact, it's one of our foundations in AA. But at this meeting, we're trying to learn what the text is teaching. We want to set aside all of your experience and say, what are they trying to get across here? It's a very unique meeting. We've been meeting for 14 years. We have 250 people in Austin meeting at that meeting, which just blows me away. I mean, it's the biggest meeting, weekly meeting in Austin, Texas. We had such a great success on Zoom with it. We got up to 600 people on Zoom that we decided, the group conscience elected, to start a Zoom meeting on Wednesday night only, different from our Tuesday night. We started at the beginning of the book, and it's on Tuesday nights it's on Wednesday nights at 7:30 Central Standard Time. And I'll put in the chat or at my name, the Zoom number to get in there if you're interested. We're in the doctor's opinion. No, we just did the doctor's opinion. We're in Bill's story right now. It's a very, very interesting meeting. If it sounds like it's something that floats your boat, man, come join us. If you're apprehensive, come sit in one meeting, see what you think. You know, we alcoholics, we prejudge everything, myself included. We prejudge everything. You know, it says, prior to investigation, contempt. That's what we do by nature. It's our default setting most of the time. The book talks about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I like to lean on the page that says I'm going to describe in my own language and from my own point of view the way I established my relationship with God. I'm more interested in my relationship with God, teaching how the book gets me to that, how the steps get me to that. I like to say staying spiritually fit is not easy, right? You can go through, I thought I turned my phone off. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Hold on 1 second. Let me put it on airplane mode. David, I'm telling you, I am just not all together tonight, but my timer's on. So staying spiritually fit's not easy. Of course it's not easy. I mean, none of this for us is easy. And we are some of the most blessed people ever to have these 12 steps to keep us on track. The rest of the world doesn't usually operate in the parameters that we have to operate in. We need to make it tight. I like to say it's easier to get a drunk to quit drinking than it is to get one of us to quit playing God. I mean, that's a position we don't want to give up. So really, I make my qualifications. I'll share a little bit about my story, but I keep my qualifications tight. When I start, I can't stop, and I can't stop starting. That's what qualifies me as alcoholic. And all of us have different drinking experiences. See, that's why I like our big book study. Sometimes, and this is what's happened in time. Bill and Bob knew that. That's why they put it in a book, and hopefully it's virtually untouched. But they knew that we would play this game of telephone. And as you go along, we will change this program if we're not careful. And I certainly did plenty of that. And so everybody has a different experience in drinking. So sometimes people are sitting there waiting for somebody that drank like them. They get it. Or somebody who's had that experience in life. They get it. See, we don't have to have that. Certainly does help for some empathy and compassion. But I don't have to have had the same. I don't have to have had the car accident. I don't have to have killed somebody in a drunk driving. I don't have to have done a lot of these things. Prison time, cirrhosis of the liver. All these things I don't have to have. The book tells me how to deal with this. That's the beauty. I missed all of this for a very, very long time. I was the youngest of three. I was born in 1958. We were all 2 years apart, right? That was the nature of what it was. I came out of the womb driven. I swear to God, I am feeling, I shot out of the womb like Mighty Mouse, standing there with my little cape going, you know, I still am like that. I mean, I am so driven. I was driven as a child. I'm a budding alcoholic. My brother's a hard drinker. He's the oldest. My sister is an Al-Anon who likes to get her drink on. And I'm the real McCoy. You know, was my dad alcoholic? You know, now that I know more about what the qualifications for alcoholism are, I think my dad was a hard drinker. I really do. Sometimes we use this phrase, a functioning alcoholic. Not quite sure what that means, right? Because it could very well be a hard drinker. Given sufficient reason, they could stop or moderate. Most alcoholism goes down. It doesn't stay at a moderate level. Now, don't get me wrong. There's families that can enable and they can keep their jobs and all of that. But odds of them being alcoholic are debatable. And that's what working with others really gets into. First 7 pages is that first visit to the guy. And it really explains what we are supposed to do to qualify, to see if this guy is alcoholic or not. So I'm driven as this child, right? And when I was 8 years old, my mother got very, very sick. And the next thing we know, she goes into the hospital, and it literally felt like she went in the hospital one day. And the next morning, my dad comes in, sits on the bed and says, "Your mom died." And it was like she died in a car accident. She had a kidney disease, and she died of the kidney disease. And it's tragic. It was horrible. And my dad told us that moment, he said, "We're going to be fine." He was an ex-NFL football player. He worked for Union Carbide. We lived in Houston, Texas. So he had to go back and forth up to Pittsburgh on Mondays and come home on Fridays. So my dad remarried 3 times in an 18-month period. And we had 4 live-in housekeepers. My husband likes to say, well, he could close a deal. Yeah, why, yes, he could close a deal. Couldn't keep the deal closed, but he could close a deal. And I got to tell you something. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you that that's what made me alcoholic, because I believed something happened to make us alcoholic. And I got to tell you, a ton of people in AA still believe something made them alcoholic. The society believes something made us alcoholic. I understand it today as a genetic bullet. But let me tell you, if you work with folks, a lot of folks, and say you're working with somebody that's, you know, 23 years old, and you happen to be talking to the parents, as the book says, well, we hope we get involved with the family. You're talking to the parents, and the first thing the mother will say is, "What did I do wrong? I know I did something wrong," because they want to blame themselves for alcoholism. Today, we understand it as a genetic bullet. One, all the kids have blue eyes. I have brown eyes. It's no different than that. Breast cancer is genetic, hands down, right? And so I swear to God, I believe something made me alcoholic, this whole situation. And what I understand today is I have an allergy and a mental obsession. That's what makes me alcoholic. But what happened with that tragedy that happened in my life, or whatever upbringing, you don't have to have a tragic upbringing, it influenced my old ideas. I mean, I have some really, really bizarre old ideas on what I can and cannot do. And, you know, the book says we can't fool ourselves about values. Values are old ideas. And so if it influenced my old ideas, it says in the how it works, that we have to get rid of these old ideas. The result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. And then you ask somebody, what's your old ideas? Hell, I didn't even know what that term meant. Well, it means my belief systems. And most people go back to the belief systems they had when they came into AA on day one. And I get it. Don't get me wrong. I did all these things. Well, I've got an old idea on a pandemic. I can tell you that. And because I've never been in one. So this is why our old ideas are constantly changing. Where do we find our old ideas? In a third column of a four column inventory, right? Your self-esteem, your pride, your ambition, your security, your deep-seated personal relationships. And one of the things about that inventory, sometimes we talk about inventory as we only do inventory once when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh my gosh, the 10 steps trying to wake us up to the need for continual inventory. So if this is in that third column and it's affected your self-esteem, I like to ask the question, how? How did it affect your self-esteem? Well, my self-esteem is the value I've placed on myself. So it usually starts with an I am statement, right? My pride is the value I've placed on the way others that see me. So that's a no one could, should, or would. You're probably sitting there going, well, she's speaking a different language. I get it. Dan Sherman was the one who introduced this whole concept in Big Book Awaken, just blew the doors off my inventories. But it is really important to not just checklist those things, but to get down to what are these old ideas that are driving me. Then in a fear inventory, and the book is a little bit nebulous on how you do a fear inventory. Is it a two-column inventory, a three-column inventory, a four-column inventory? I do it as a four-column inventory. Whatever one you do it as, it's the column that self-reliance is in. Because see, self-reliance, the fear that I have in life is pushing, my self-reliance is what's pushing that fear. Well, what is the old idea behind that fear that's causing me so much problem? And then the third piece of inventory is the sex inventory, right? It's actually a conduct inventory with an emphasis on sex. Once you know, it says that we should treat sex like everything else, you know, so that lets that be a conduct inventory. What do I mean by that? How do I show up as a sister? How do I show up as a neighbor? How am I showing up as a wife? Am I arousing jealousy, bitterness, suspicion? All of these things can go in any aspect of my life. Well, where are your old ideas? They're all over that inventory. That's just basically the fourth column of a resentment inventory. It's very, very interesting when you look at this stuff. Well, so this is the importance of my story so that you can begin to understand where all of this plays a part in my life. I started drinking at 12. I don't know why that seems to be the magic number for most alcoholics, usually between 11 and 13. And I found booze at 12. I remember my first drink. My God, I'll never forget standing at my dad's bar. My brother made me a depth charge. And I remember when I took that drink. Now, remember, I came out of the womb driven. I came out of the womb as extremely confident. I was not somebody that took the drink and became confident. What I did is I took the drink and I could then climb the highest mountain, right? I knew I could probably climb that mountain, but now there's no doubt I was going to get to that mountain. So it fueled something in me that is so driven. I got to tell you, as a little bitty woman, and my husband always says, you are that big and you scare the crap out of me. I like that. I've been like that all my life. I'm a very big personality and I've always been like that. So imagine what booze did for that. And when I quit drinking, I didn't lose that. But I'll tell you what, I was certainly cocky. You know, you scare me bad enough and I get very cocky. But you're 12 years old, for God's sake, you can't find booze that easy. So what did we do? Me and my two little girlfriends got on our little Schwinn bicycles and rode down to the 7-Eleven, right, the convenience store. And we sat there and waited for the creepy guy. Now we're 12 years old and keep in mind, we're fairly seasoned, if you know what I mean. And we're waiting for the creepy guy. I'm waiting for my mark right then at 12. Now, when we see the guy, because we spot him, we say, hey, buddy, can you buy us some booze? He goes, well, I certainly can. And why does he say it? Because he's creepy, right? And the biggest problem we had was dropping the creepy guy. Well, he was in a car. We were on our bicycles going into the woods. It wasn't that difficult. But some of the reason I say that is because we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a funny little atmosphere right now that women can't take care of themselves, and you know that they need to be protected. And I'm not saying there's some real creeps in AA, but I have been in AA for 36 years, and I have never, ever had anybody ever treat me poorly like that. And if anyone even came close to it, what would I say? Knock it off, Dan. You're bugging the crap out. You're creeping out the new chick over there. Stop it. You know, in the bar, we did that. All of a sudden, we come into AA, we turn into some sort of snowflake. Don't get me wrong. I know there's the ego turned inward and that real quiet personality. I get that. Well, then march up to me and say, Katie, you know, Dan over there is bugging the crap out of me. I'll march right over there. Dan, get off. The heck are you doing, buddy? Scared the crap out of that little snowflake over there. Stop it. Right. Don't even get me going. But as a woman with 36 years sober, now don't get me wrong. I have heard some ugly stories, but it is not the majority. It is the minority. Right. Okay. So now here comes this budding little alcoholic. My dad, the last time he remarried in that 18-month period, she remained my stepmom for the rest of her life. And she and I fought like cats and dogs. My dad and I fought like cats and dogs. I'm a budding little alcoholic, let's not forget. So I'm a pain in the ass, is really. It's a short version of it. And one time I came home, I'd lied to him about something. She caught me in the lie. And my dad said, listen, if you can't live under the rules of this house, you can't live here. And I know my dad didn't mean that, but I saw that as a ticket out. And I left home at 15 and I never went back. Now, my dad and I mended our ways somewhat, very, very weak, amends I made in AA. And I'll get more into that. But I'll tell you something. I left home at 15. I was going to finish high school. Absolutely, I did. I talked a woman into renting me a little place. All of these things, right? Self-reliance worked for me. So when I come into AA and you want me to set down the tool that worked so well, I don't think so. I think you all might need to do that, but I'm not going to do that. Just get the drink off of me. And I got it from here. And I am so not alone in that. I think people make that deal and they don't even know they made that deal. But I'll ask you some questions as I go on, because let me tell you what, the walls I hit in Alcoholics Anonymous were some dandies, and everybody's going to hit walls. That's what spiritual growth is about. Pain is the touchstone of growth, right? That's why we need to lean on God, because of the pain that we put ourselves in. I'm trudging through life, la, 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 and then along comes a boy, and I chase this boy into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you something. He had 6 years. I had 10 minutes. It was a match made in heaven, baby. Thank God nobody was the arbiter of my sex life. Thank God nobody was saying, wait a year, you know, which I think is, it's an interesting philosophy. Nobody's ever done it, but it's interesting. But I chased this boy into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a single mother. I had a five-year-old. Remember, I was 26 years old. I was raised on values. I knew the difference between right and wrong. I drugged that little girl in places she had no business being. I know pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But I also thought, it was 1984, I thought my outside issues were the problems. Leave my booze alone. Just get that other stuff, the dry goods off of me. And thank God the girl that was at that meeting when I chased Joe in there gave me a really good first step experience. Now, I didn't understand it all, but she made it very clear that I can't do one without the other. When you do the other, were you drinking? You bet I was. And that's where, thank God, she got me. I also got to tell you something. I was one of the lucky ones. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I fell in love with you guys. I assumed that was everybody's experience. Come to find out, I'm the minority in that situation. So what did that do for me? It bought me more time. There's people who don't want to be here. They don't want to be here for 5 minutes. They don't want to walk through that door, and they don't like us. Well, I liked everybody. I didn't want to disappoint you. And Joe kept saying, Katie, this is all wrong. You know, la, 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 la. And I'm like, shh, come to the light. Come to, as the we women are, come to the light. Next thing you know, he's in my vortex and whoop, let me bring him in the boat. And thank God nobody stopped us, because Joe and I were married for 20 years. We had a child. He was an amazing father. He was a great AA. He used to read the big book and I'd sit at his feet. I know some of you guys, that might creep you out. I loved it. He was a good man. He was alcoholic, but he was a good man. And so I meet Joe, and he's already 6 years ahead of me. So he's kind of telling me what I got to do. This is what I got to do. And he kept saying, Katie, I think this is all wrong. You know, we waited 19 days before he moved in. We were pretty proud of that. And, but this is my experience. It's 1984. I think Alcoholics Anonymous, there's three things I thought. Alcoholics Anonymous was about not drinking, right? If you read the big book, for God's sakes, it was written in 1935. It's not making any sense to me. Everybody that's doing AA wants to change the big book. They're all going to go through that phase. Fine, go through that phase. And then you'll grow to respect every word of that big book from 1935. We don't need to he, she, and it. We don't need to do any of that nonsense. We leave the big book intact. Why? Because it's a piece of spiritual literature. And so I think that AA is about the drink problem, right? Physical sobriety looks like recovery. It's 1984. What's the big thing happened in 1984? Codependency, right? What color's your parachute? John Bradshaw, bring your little stuffed animal into an AA meeting. I mean, we thought we had arrived, and Joe also thought that. So we're doing this codependency group therapy stuff. And I'm telling you, it's basically counseling, right? Counseling is for life problems. Now, I'm a fan of counseling. I think counseling's a privilege. The only problem, and there is a problem, is what happens in counseling. You come in there and you basically do an inventory. Who are you mad at in column one? My dad. What did he do in column two? Well, he loved my sister more than me. He always shamed me, and he made fun of me all the time. Okay, there's your good column two. Column three. It affected my self-esteem, right? Because I was a good child, right? Now, I just told you, I invited my father to kick me out of the house. See, here comes the delusion. But when you're telling her, a counselor, that, she's respecting what I'm saying. She is seeing it from my perspective, not my dad's perspective. And then when we finish the body of work there, she sends me on my way. She never gets to the fourth column. Right? The fourth column is, where was I? Selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, afraid. Let's break that down to self-righteous, self-reliant, self-pity. Let's get into all these things to see how I showed up, because her job is not to say you got to go make an amends to your dad. That's our job in AA. So I always say, if you go to counseling, be sure you take all that stuff to your sponsor. Because I'm telling you, if you listen to a lot of inventory, and I listen to a ton of inventory, is we're going to teach you something from an entirely different angle. What angle is that? The angle of the other person. Is it possible that you're living in a delusional mindset of how this went down? Mark Houston woke us up at 17 years, and he used to say, column four makes column two a lie. And I couldn't ever figure out what he meant by that. It's, I've been believing this delusional lie about my family, and it wasn't even true. Now, physical abuse and sexual abuse, please understand, that's horrific. That is a horrific situation. We're removing those two. Not everybody had that. As a matter of fact, that again is the minority have that happen. And we want to act like everyone has that happen. That's just at least the amount of inventory I listen to. That's not true. But when that does happen, we deal with that differently. And then I love on the bottom of page 19, top of page 20, it says most of us sense the real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints are basically my guiding line. Our very lives as an ex-prom drinker depends on the constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. Right now, I'm learning boundaries and detachment. And sometimes that gets people's butt puckering. I hear you. But let me tell you, nowhere in our book it says that. It says, as our very lives as an ex-prom drinker, my life depends upon the constant thought. Now, that doesn't mean I got to go take them to coffee every day. Of course not. But I've got to do this inventory. Why? Here's an example. Let's take somebody in AA that you don't like. Is that a far stretch? Not at all. Oh my God, I've written more inventory on AA members than I've ever written on my family. So let's just take the guy in AA that bugs you. How about you don't even know him? As a matter of fact, when he walked in, you went, yeah, I already don't like that guy. Never even spoke a word to him. See how often that happens. And so you don't like this guy. Well, why don't you like this guy? You call your sponsor, go, I can't stand this gym guy. He just wears my butt out. I just don't even like the way he sits in his chair. So I write the inventory on this guy to figure out what it is about him that bothers me. What is driving me behind this guy? Why? Not because Jim's got a problem, I do. And Jim is going to be my son-in-law. He's going to be my neighbor. He's going to be my boss. So I better get down to causes and conditions behind this guy that causes my problems. And let me tell you, if you haven't written inventory in a while, wow, I didn't write it in 15 years. I wrote the bulk when I came in. I didn't write another piece of inventory for 15 years. I write in my evening review. And by the way, that is the 11th step. I thought it was the 10th step forever. Come to find out the 10th step is a spot check inventory taken throughout the day, right? We're to watch for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear. And when these crop up, ask God at once to remove them. Talk to someone immediately. Make amends quickly if we've harmed anybody, and then resolutely turn our thoughts, not our actions, to someone we could help. What? Thought it was the evening review. No, the evening review is we're going to check our work. That's the 11th step. When we retire at night, were we resentful, dishonest, selfish, or afraid, right? All these many questions. And it's got a little drunk trap in it. It says, have we kept something to ourselves that should have been shared with someone else? What's that really saying? Did you do a 10th step, dummy? You should have called somebody on that, right? Don't get in that misunderstanding of those two steps. They are truly the discipline steps. They're not maintenance. They are discipline. And we are undisciplined. God has disciplined us in this very way. And so then, and here's a little insight. After I realized the 10th step was not the evening review, I then took the 10th step off the wall, right? And then made it like we continue to take personal inventory, and when we've harmed someone, make amends, right? That's basically it. So I used it as damage control only. So what I would do is I would be completely asleep in life, dreaming that I'm awake. I'd step on your toes. I'd step on David's toes, right? Not show up at his meeting. Step on David's toes. He can't believe it, which of course was not at all how he handled it. But let's just assume he was frustrated. He wasn't, but he's frustrated. Dave, I am so sorry. You know, la, 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 la. And he says, you know what, Katie, I understand. It's all good. And then I fall back asleep and I go through life dreaming I'm awake. See, I never had a completely awakened spirit. And I didn't even know it was possible. Mark Houston used to say, you know, I die at night. I'm reborn in the morning. You know, I can drink water. And I think, dude, chill out. You're a little overboard. Well, now I'm him. And we lost Mark Houston way too soon. He was 63 years old. We lost him a little over 10 years ago. We lost Dan Sherman, another incredible man in Alcoholics Anonymous that took this stuff deeper. My dear friend, Gary Brown said, he's got 50 plus years sober. And he said, you know what, Katie, I believe that God knew we alcoholics would have, for heaven's sakes, the internet. Any question you have can be answered like that. And he knew that we were going to have to go deeper and deeper and deeper. People act like, well, that's not what Bill and Bob were doing. Well, heck, some of them never left their hometown, right? I mean, that was a different day and age as far as, you know, air travel and everything. And so we have to go deeper. We have to realize, my God, nowadays you can open up Facebook and get pissed off before you took a sip of coffee. I don't have Facebook because of that. I never even opened it. I did enough 10 steps. People called me on it. Oh, I am not touching that thing with a 10-foot pole. You know, so you will not find me on any social media. When I found out you could like or dislike somebody, or friend or not friend, that was enough for me. I'm not writing that much inventory. That's just my take. So here we go. Now listen to this. This is another interesting thing. And David gave me some freedom to kind of go all over the place, not just my story. Don Majors didn't want to just do his story because we get tired of it. And is it effective? Of course it is. I think it's more effective drunk to drunk, if you ask me, knee to knee, when I'm talking to that new guy to talk to him about my drinking. This is not at all about drinking. We are past drinking, right? In your first year of sobriety, we are going to be moving you into what the root of your problem is. Selfishness and self-centeredness. That's what we want to wake you up to. Now, you're not going to wake up to that till about 3 years sober. But I can promise you at 36 years sober, I'm not calling my sponsor upset saying, well, I'm not going to drink, Marty. Of course, that's not what we're talking about. I could be absolutely disturbed. I call it untreated alcoholism. If you are absolutely disturbed and living in those bedevilments on page 52, boy, ask yourself that question. And I had no idea I had entered into untreated alcoholism, because I'm sitting in this codependency group therapy for 10 years with all my AA friends, all my Al-Anon friends. We are digging deep. It wasn't for sissies, man. It was tough. I'm learning boundaries, detachment. And let me give you something here. The big book, you know, written in 1935. But one of the things about that is the words need to be understood, right? We use terminology like codependent, controlling, expectations, belief systems, right? That's what we say today. I like to teach my sponsees what those words are in the big book. We're not changing the big book. So the word codependent slash manipulation is, if everyone in the third step, if everyone would do as I wish, the show would be great. Everyone, including me, would be happy. Oh, how bad can that be? Katie-topia here, right? I am the actor running the whole show. That's the manipulation, controlling. I'm the self-seeker, even when trying to be kind. Expectations, our book uses the word ambition. And then belief systems, like I said earlier, is the book uses old ideas, prejudice, values. I love in the fourth step where it says we can't fool ourselves about values. Oh my gosh, the atmosphere we're in, you are challenged for your values. That's why everyone is so disturbed. Oh yeah, is there, and I won't touch politics because it tells us not to do that, or religion. But let me tell you something, everyone is disturbed. Look at your value system. That's what it's challenging here. And I tell you, I like to say, if you like the big book, great. And if you don't like the big book, great. Let's have no fighting in the lifeboat. Man, don't, the big book people don't stand in the way that of the guy that doesn't like the big book, and the guy that doesn't like the big book or care much for it, you know, using it, don't stand in the way of the guy that does. And we're picking each other off in AA. It's really unfortunate. And then the third thing I misunderstood was church. It said we have to find this higher power. This is a spiritual program, right? Well, I've always leaned towards Western religion. And, you know, there's Eastern Buddhism, Judaism, Native American. You can choose whatever. We throw the gates so wide open. It's fine for you to choose whatever you want. But I chose the Western religion. And it was very interesting because in Roland Hazard, when we're talking about Roland Hazard and Carl Jung was just this, you know, renowned psychiatrist, unbelievable man. You should read some of his stuff. It's really quite fascinating. He's a psychiatrist with a strong spiritual background. And Roland Hazard came from a wealthy family. AA, of course, is not around. And he gets on a boat and he goes over to Europe on a big liner. And he goes and stays with Carl Jung for 1 year. Can you imagine that? He stayed with Carl Jung for 1 year trying to get sober. And he remained sober for 1 year. And then he's going to leave Carl Jung. He's going to come back to America. And he doesn't even make it to the ship, and he gets drunk. And he crawls his way back to Carl Jung. And he goes, oh my God, what is wrong with me? How can this be? And, you know, am I going to have to get a bodyguard? Remember that all that through 27, 29 in the big book? And Carl Jung says, I've been trying to get you to have a spiritual experience, a vital spiritual experience. And listen to what Roland Hazard said. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, Roland Hazard, for he reflected that after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. So what does that translate to us? What happens is people, we come into AA and around 3 years, we get restless. We start looking around going, man, I'm sick of making the coffee. I'm sick of doing this. I'm sponsoring people. These meetings are getting in my way because the gifts of sobriety have begun happening, right? You get a better job. You might have another kid. You get a couple of cars. And the next thing you know, AA is becoming a nuisance. Everybody goes through that experience. It's the nature of it, right? And then the next thing you know, we're elbowing our way out of AA. And we don't even realize, and say I've decided to go to church. And instead, here's another one. And I'm telling you what, I did decide to go to church at 3 years sober. And Joe said to me, he goes, remember, he always had 6 years more than me. And he had 9 years sober. And we're doing the codependency group therapy. We're all about staying sober. He said, let's go to church. And I think, nah, I don't really want to go. And he goes, no, Katie, you're going to love this church. we went into this non-denominational church. They had the screens pulled down, everybody singing. And I mean, I felt something right here. And I thought, that's it. This is exactly what I need. Now, don't get me wrong. I am by no means saying there's anything wrong with going to church. There's nothing wrong going to the temple, kneeling in the ashrams, nothing wrong with that. But it is to be done with, not instead of. And so what Joe and I did is we were all about staying sober, but we were kind of done with AA for the time. And we became a member of this church. Oh my God, we looked Amish. I was just a sunbeam. Oh Jesus. You know that guy in AA who's going to come back and save all you heathens? Well, I tried that, ran off all my friends. And I mean, I even started wearing underwear. Okay. And I swear my sweet Al-Anon friend Larsine loves to say, you know, none of you alcoholics wear underwear. I don't know why it's not in your literature. But I mean, that's what we do. Mark used to say we're like soybeans. We take on the flavor of wherever we are. We're going to be in the PTA. We start looking like that. You know, the junior league, there you go. Motorcycle gang, there I am. That's what we do. Right? We are so much an actor in all of this process. So you hit these walls between 18 months and 3 years. The new guy does not, and I say guy because I refuse to say he, she, I won't do it. So the new guy comes into AA, and what does he have? He's looking at this and he's realizing, oh my God, we're going to teach him integrity, dignity, honor, respect. Why? Because it's important to become a part of society. Your word needs to be your word. Your word needs to be impeccable, right? So we teach this guy this. We give him the key to the club. We say, hey, open up the club, make the coffee, set up the tables and chairs. This guy is so happy. Somebody cares about him. And then at about between 18 months and 3 years, he starts looking around going, oh, this is some BS. Now they're taking advantage of me. See, behind that kind motive, it's what that third step is saying. The first requirement, I've got to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I'm not at 18 months to 3 years. And then it says, I'm almost always in collision with somebody or something, even though my motive is good. And we always tell them, check your motives. Well, if it's a good motive, I don't check it. So this new guy's looking around thinking this is BS. Next thing you know, at the meeting, he's popping off his buddies. He's tired of them. You know what? They're just taking advantage of me. I'm all about staying sober, but I'm kind of done with you guys. And then he hits another wall. If we keep him between 18 months and 3 years, he hits another wall between 3 and 5, 5 and 7, 7 and 12. 12 and 15. And it goes that way for every 3 to 5 years, you hit a different wall. And these walls that are between before 10, whew, and here's the delusion that most people have. At 10 years sober, for some reason, we think we should have arrived. We're double digits. And I warn you, I call those the teenage years. Between 10 and 20 years, you're in the teenage years where you can't tell you squat. I mean, the old timers trying to get a message across to you and you're like, this is how you're behaving. Oh, okay. Hey, thanks. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate that. Walking away going, whatever. He so doesn't have a clue what my life's about. And that's just the nature of it. And let me tell you, I sponsor half the goddamn country. I mean to tell you, I could write a book on it. Just like someone who has 10 children, they can write a book on children, right? You have one or two, you can kind of write a book, but it's not going to have the same effect. And why do we hit these walls? Because it's the nature of spiritual growth, right? A spiritual awakening is painful. The enlightenment is the beauty. So Joe and I, right, we're tooling along. We're doing the church thing for 3 years. We've got a handful of AA friends. And all of a sudden, we are not doing very well. We both know we're not doing well. The church is starting to bug the crap out of us. A bunch of the members we don't like anymore. And it says on page 14, for if an alcoholic failed to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot handle certain trials and low spots. Okay? Now, let me tell you, I don't know if that's a flat tire, a bad diagnosis at the doctor's office, a pandemic. I don't know what your highs and lows are. But let me tell you, we are in danger. And Joe and I had no idea how much in danger we were. See, we're all about learning about, you know, Jesus and God, and I'm doing Bible study fellowship. So what I was doing was looking for knowledge. It's kind of like somebody reading the big book in closing going, I got it. I got it. I got the knowledge. That's all you got. You don't have the experience. This spiritual, when we go off on these paths to find whatever spiritual path, we are not looking for knowledge. We are looking for experience. So 3 years into this deal, now I've got 6 years. Remember, Joe always had three more than me. He's got 12. And I said, what are we going to do? And he goes, you know what? We need to go back to AA. And I said, you're right. So we go back to our home group, man, we walk in that home group and there's Ed Hasbrook, Victor Moody. And we sat down and everybody, you know, hey man, great to have you guys back. And I had that feeling again. And I swear to God, I misunderstood both of those. I thought that feeling was now we've arrived. Okay, we're here. And let me tell you what we entered into, our friends, you know, brought us in fabulous, is what I call meeting-based sobriety, oral AA. And no disrespect, please don't ever hear me ever say anything bad about meetings. My God, we need them so bad. The fellowship is a part of our triangle, right? Unity, service. But without recovery, it does not treat alcoholism, nor does service treat alcoholism. Are they important to enhance our recovery experience? Yes. The only thing we know is that the 12 steps treat the illness we suffer from. Bill and Bob never really would have thought that anybody could stay sober on just meetings. Well, let me tell you, I gave it my best shot and I didn't know it. I didn't know I'd entered into untreated alcoholism. I'm not doing these disciplines. See, these disciplines are about getting me unblocked so that the sunlight of the spirit can shine. We get blocked all the time, even behind a kind motive, right? So this is what going to meetings did. And I did five meetings a week for years. And I needed a meeting, you see. That's the other kind of catch-all phrase. So I was going to a meeting and I was getting relief, not freedom. And it would look like this. I go into a meeting, I'm just overwhelmed with whatever. And the meeting's on fear. Oh, perfect. It's on fear and everybody shares about how afraid they are. And I get really, wow, I'm not the only one that's got this feeling. And then I leave and by 5 o'clock the next day, man, I need another meeting. It's on gratitude. I need to hear gratitude, right? So I'm working a program about relief, but not freedom. I'm not writing a fear inventory list. I have no idea. I'm not doing an evening review. I don't know that in the morning on awakening, I'm supposed to ask to be divorced from selfish. Self-pity is the very first thing it says. Interesting. Doesn't say fear. It says to be divorced from self-pity. It tells me I'm also to look at my 24 hours. And if you do silent meditation, that's a nice practice. Not really my cup of tea, but it's a very nice practice. That's great. Do that at the end. But otherwise, there are clear directions on what I'm to do. On awakening, look at my 24 hours ahead, ask to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. Why? Because of this level of self-centeredness that I have, right? And here it is. I call it stark raving sober. On page 25, and these are in the book, it's always giving me two options here. If you're a serious alcoholic as we are, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. Ask yourself the question. Mark used to say, turn statements into questions. Okay. Are you a serious alcoholic? Do you believe that no middle of the road solution? Yeah. So far you got me in here. Hadn't written a piece of inventory in forever. I sponsored, you know, six people. I'm giving them life coaching is what I was doing. I didn't see anything wrong with that. I thought I was doing a pretty good job. You know, how do you know what you don't know? That'll give you a brain cramp. And then when it says we were in a position where life was becoming impossible, is that true for you? Let me tell you, it is true for a lot of us. And if we passed into the region from which there's no return through human aid, there you have it. No wife, no job, no kids, no nothing is going to be able to fix you. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness. Interesting word, consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. So you're going to blot out that intolerable situation or accept spiritual help. It says it two more times in the book. A self-imposed crisis, you cannot postpone or evade. Either God's everything or he's nothing. And then avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. OK, God didn't do it, but when trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it. This is where it says lack of power was our dilemma. Why do they use the word dilemma? Because they both suck. When I need $200 by tomorrow, am I going to pray about it? I doubt it. Oh, I might tell you I am, but I doubt it. I'm going to get on the phone and find that $200. I'm going to go into self-reliance. Now I'm 36 years sober. Let me tell you something. I go to prayer now immediately. And I don't mean I don't just go to prayer. I call my sponsor. I'm writing inventory. I'm watching throughout the day. This watch is a discipline. It's an action. It's a call to action. I am to watch my thinking, not my actions, right? My actions, once I'm into my actions, oh, we've already crossed that line. I am watching my thinking. My thinking by nature is pretty dark. As a matter of fact, I'll give you something to try. When you go get off this meeting till you go to bed, just observe your thinking mind. It's remarkable what it does. And it's usually quite negative, right? And so here's the deal. You're tooling along in what I call meeting-based sobriety. And I'm really struggling. I'm having a heck of a time. I don't really have a sponsor. That's not too terribly unusual. Some people say they have a sponsor, but never use them. I don't care how you want to cloak it. But so I'm tooling along and all of a sudden I'm having a problem. I go up to somebody and I tell them the problem. They look at me and go, well, where's God in all that? Well, I want to slap the crap out of them. Well, he's clearly not there, okay? And what they don't understand is they're handing me a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism. Many of us would have, right? So what you're doing is you're giving me the promise and asking me to work the promise and hope the step comes true. You see, they need to go, okay, well, let's see. Okay, so what is it about your brother that's got you so upset? Let's put him in column one. You can do a verbal four-column inventory like that. See, when the book says that we need to be armed with the facts about ourselves, we need a message of depth and weight, didn't mean I wasn't helpful in AA. Oh, I was helping a lot of people, but I wasn't doing anything for alcoholism. And let me tell you, today, I get it. I got it. I get it. I can go, I can talk to complete strangers on the phone, walk them through an inventory, and they are in tears and in freedom. That's what our job is. That's what everybody here's job is. Well, Joe and I do this untreated, do this meeting-based sobriety for quite a few years. And I'm now at about maybe 10 years sober. It's that much of a blur. We're very active in AA. Joe gets very, very sick. And we don't know what's going on. Something's wrong with his head. And I'm sharing about it in my meeting, you know. And one of my girlfriends said, you know, Katie, you ought to drive a school bus. You get an instant HMO. And I was a fitness professional, been an athlete all my life. And I was making really good money in the business. And Joe was a high-end cabinet maker. We were basically, you know, middle class, a little bit of upper middle class, doing fine. And, but we had bad insurance. We both had catastrophic insurance. And this psychiatrist tells me we need to have his head scanned. And I'm like, what? So I go down because see, I'm a self-reliant girl. I don't go work a piece of inferior inventory and ask God what to do. I go get a job driving a goddamn school bus. Now, let's just all absorb that, okay? And so I'm driving a school bus and I'm in a nice neighborhood, right? I wasn't going into a really, really rough neighborhood. I think if I'd done that, someone was going to be dead. And I can't really tell you it was going to be me. But I'm driving this school bus because I'm going to get Joe. He gets an instant HMO, no pre-existing, no nothing. It's a great system. Put that in your back pocket if you ever need it. So I go to this bus job and I tell Joe, you need to go get your head scanned because my mind says I'm going to do this for about 2 weeks, 4 weeks max. And it was intense getting that bus job. Let me tell you, that's a whole nother story. You ought to do a workshop, listen to one of our workshops. But so Joe can't get in to see a neurologist for 3 months. And I'm like, oh no, we're not doing that. So I call my GP and my GP says, you know what, Katie, let's just take him in the emergency room, get his head scanned. We'll get to the bottom of this. And so I tell Joe, I mean, we stopped and had lunch for heaven's sakes. It wasn't like he cut his arm off. We stopped, had lunch and we get in there and I tell him, now look, Joe, fail these tests. So we're not getting out of here till they run every test they need to run on you. Okay. Okay. So we get in there and the doc says, you know, touch your nose. And Joe goes, touches his nose. Touch your elbow. And Joe touches his elbow. And I'm standing behind the doctor going, what are you doing, dude? You guys know the game here. we're like, oh no, I'm not going to sit there and go, I'm going to go knock it off. And so the next thing you know, the doc is not buying into doing a bunch of testing. And then he says, Joe, what's 2 + 2? And Joe says, you know, I should know that. I don't know that. And the doc says, we're going to go scan your head. So he goes in there and he scans his head, and it takes forever. It must have been an hour. We're in the emergency room. You know, the little curtain is pulled. And that doc comes walking in, and I'm sitting in the chair and Joe is on the bed. And he puts his hand right here and he goes, my God, he's got a tumor as big as my fist in his head. And he said, my God, 3 times. And my very first thought in my head was, oh my God, I'm going to be driving this school bus forever. Yeah. Welcome to alcoholism. You go say that down at the PTA and they cover their mouth. You say that in a room full of alcoholics and they go, I get it. No, I didn't say that. Of course I did. It was like, what? He can't have a brain tumor. And I crawled up in bed with Joe. We weren't leaving the hospital, I can tell you that. He was there for 11 days. He had a 14-hour surgery. Oh my God, what an experience. AA came out like AA does. They thought he was a movie star. We had so many people. We were so active in AA. But let me tell you something, and I could go into bus stories, but I'm not going to do it here. You have to hear another one of my stories. I'm going to go, David, for about another 5-6 minutes, because this is a crucial part of this. I am losing my mind. The doc tells me, he sits me down in the hospital and says he'll never work another day in his life. The tumor ended up being benign. They were blown away. So Joe wasn't going to die of the tumor, but he had some pretty severe brain damage from it, right? Now, if you talk to him, you really couldn't see it. He didn't have anything physically wrong with him, but he just couldn't sustain a job. And the doc says to me, he goes, ma'am, he's never going to work another day in his life. It was like I swallowed a tennis ball. Okay. We had a kid in college and a kid in elementary school. We are a two-income family. And you tell me he will never, it makes me emotional now because I'm wrapped a little tight, but let me tell you something. I will never forget that moment in time when I thought, my God, you tell a girl like me that we need money? All I know to do is go make money. I apply for Social Security disability. They deny us. They denied us for 22 months. People are saying, go get a lawyer. Go get a lawyer. Kiss my foot. I'm not giving a lawyer half the money I paid. I've worked since I was 13 years old. I said, I'm going to get this. And by God, I finally got it by going to a senator. And I ended up getting that disability. But what it ended up doing for us that was heartbreaking is it keeps you really, really low income. And that's painful, guys. The whole system is screwed up. I don't even want to talk about that. But what happened is I'm in those bedevilments and untreated alcoholism. I'm out there trying to hold the family together. I am busting my ass to make money. This disability was nice, but it's not enough to live on. It says on page 52, those bedevilments, we were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. Ask yourself these questions. We were prey to misery and depression. Prey like a vulture preys. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. I had 3 blow-in-the-bag anxiety attacks during that period. I never had an anxiety attack in my life. Let me tell you something. That's untreated alcoholism for most of us. And I could get down another road, but I'm going to save it because of the time. But I got to tell you something. Joe and I are putting this together, 1 foot in front of the other. We get through this deal 6 years. And remember what I told you. For if an alcoholic fails to enlarge his life, his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice, he cannot handle certain trials and low spots. We had so many miracles happen to us. Unbelievable. And everyone does. And the next thing you know, Joe relapses at 23 years sober. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Of course, relapse is available for all of us. We know that, but not us. It's not going to happen. Look what we went through. And Joe ends up dying of a heroin overdose in 2003. And no one was more shocked than I was. I couldn't believe he relapsed. And then I couldn't believe he died. And let me tell you something. Now I am absolutely off the chain, losing my mind. I'm thinking, you know what? Screw all of this. And I'm not about to drink because I'm very well known in AA, right? All these people in my home group, I wasn't known like I am today. Not that that's a big deal, but you know what I'm saying. But I was known. And one of the things I can tell you is I wasn't going to be the girl that drinks. I was going to be the girl that takes myself out. You see, you hear people do that. People either relapse kill themselves. This happens all the time in AA. I had no idea that could be me. Charlie, my best friend, had a plane crash. He's having a spiritual awakening. I'm having this incredible spiritual awakening, right? Well, I'm losing my mind. Feels like you're free falling in black space is what a spiritual awakening feels like. And it's the enlightenment, remember, that I said. And the next thing you know, God sends lifeboat after lifeboat after lifeboat, because that's what he does. And who do we get in our life? Mark Houston. And Mark Houston wakes us up to selfishness and self-centeredness. My God, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, right? I thought it meant stingy and conceited. Well, I was voted most likable 4 years in a row in high school. I am clearly not that. Now, my friend Charlie Parker, he is that. Oh my God. See, I don't think too much of myself or too little of myself. All I think about is me. See, life's not coming at me. It's coming from me. I didn't get any of that. I love where it says the world and its people really do dominate us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, have the power to kill, right? So it's just the world and its people. Other than that, go have a good day. And then it tells me I'm a victim of the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world by if I only managed well. So I'm tricked or duped by my delusional mind. The word delusional means an impression that is firmly maintained despite being contradicted by what's accepted as reality. Yeah, typically a symptom of a mental disorder. Yeah, that's it. And then rest, seized by force, being right and happy. You know, people say, would you rather be right or happy? Once again, I'm like, really? You're going to ask me that question? Well, I'll be honest with you. I'd rather be right. I really would. That's the truth of the matter. That's most of us. I want to be happy. Yeah, you still want to be right. It's in our DNA. We are extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. Yeah, there you go. That little comma right there changes everything. See, I mean, this. I am driven by this self-centered fear, self-righteous, self-pity. Doesn't matter. It says that our troubles are of our own making. One of the greatest promises in our book is that line right there. See, if I want to be free, the problem has to be me. And there is no justifiable resentment. It's called forgiveness. And then it says something beautiful. It says the terms of the deal. Believe it or not, David, I'm not even at 1 hour, but I'm at the top of the hour. So I'm going to go just for a few more minutes here. The terms of the deal, it says God does not make too hard of terms for those who seek him. Here is the term on page 63. He provided what we needed if we keep close to him and perform his work well. In order to keep close to him, I got to get close to him. In order to get close to him, I got to get unblocked. I got to get unblocked and try to remain unblocked and then take care of God's kids. See, God had, I'm living in this bungalow. Most of my sobriety. I have no idea. God's got this unbelievable palace, right? And so that's what we're trying to get to. I'll tell you the 10th step at a later date. I'm sorry. I don't want to really disrespect my time here. I do like to say my pride thinks it's protecting me when in fact, it's really trying to kill me. I'm here talking to middle management, right? The new guy is the blood of the deal. The guy with time is the oxygen. The blood cannot survive without the oxygen. If you have 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 years sober, that's who I want to wake up to this deal. It's a real big deal. And if you're not in the book, please get in the book. And if you are, I'll see you on the firing lines. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, Katie, that was amazing. Oh my God. I'm going to unmute everybody just for a second. Just let them say thanks.
Thank you, Katie. That was wonderful. Thank I love you. Your enthusiasm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you, Katie.
Sure.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you very much. That was great.
All right. I'm going to take it back. You know, Katie, I'm only happy when I'm right. So there's that. Let's see. Let's give Katie a little bit of a break. Really, we're just going to do a couple minutes here. We'll do the seventh tradition and allow Katie to take a breath. And I'm going to read. Also, by the way, as you get questions, send them to the user questions, please. Larry is sitting back there waiting for your questions. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I am willing to take a few announcements by show of hands. Anybody? All right, hearing none. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So we have another block of time with our dear Katie. Thank you so much. That was just amazing. One last plea for questions to come in. I see I've got a couple in here. Katie, you talked about relief versus freedom. Is there any more in there to talk about? That's an amazing distinction.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, you know, honestly, I'm not here to make anybody feel guilty of their AA program or anything like that. If anything, I hope you got the idea that this was my experience based on only doing meetings. And what happens is meetings and service fall under that category, right? Actively involved in service and doing this and getting a service sponsor and la, la, la. And that's all great. But what happens is you get relief from that. And it's wonderful to do those things, but you don't get the freedom of getting unblocked so that you're not speaking of this higher power, this God of your understanding, that you're actually unblocked where you hear the undeniable voice of God, that you actually have the, you have that. Mark said, if you read 10 and 11, it talks about having entered the realm of the spirit. I remembered reading that one time and thinking, I have no idea what that means. That sounds kind of churchy to me. And I had done the whole church thing. And so you get into anytime, this is the way my sponsor puts it. If you go to a meeting for you, you're going for the wrong reason. And that one was a tough one. I thought, oh, well, shut up. Because I got to go to the meeting and raise my hand and tell them I'm having trouble. It's not at all what a meeting was designed for. That's between you and your sponsor. You need to go to the meeting with the solution so that you give the hope instead of constantly, you know, the guy at the meeting raises his hand and, oh, he's going to talk about that divorce again. Oh, good God. We're all stuck. We're held hostage. And that's what I thought it was because it's on our watch, right? And it's, you know, I was the leader of the pack in that. Trust me. Anybody had a problem? It's like teenagers right here. I want to talk about those teenagers, pain in my butt, you know? So hopefully you can make the distinction now that you've kind of been a little awakened by it.
You kind of covered a couple of my pet peeves, like the common phrases in AA, like meeting makers make it and service keeps you sober. Are there any others in there that sort of are common but are contrary to really to what we're trying to do?
Well, I think there's things like nobody gets to AA by mistake. They damn sure do. You know, the judges make them come to AA. They could be a hard drinker, not an alcoholic, because they got a DUI. I mean, the way I see the singleness of purpose is a very hot topic. I understand it today. But here's the tricky thing. The meeting makers right now are not doing okay. We just got some horrific news that a guy took his life with 35 years and he was a meeting maker. And there, all of a sudden you cut off meetings for 6 months to that guy who's not got an AA program and Zoom is not doing it. I'm having a hard time, and I consider that I work a very stellar AA program for me. I don't miss my disciplines. Now, I don't do them because I got to do them. I do them because I want to do them. So I've redoubled my efforts. My prayer and meditation used to be usually 20, 22 minutes. It's now 45 to 50 minutes. My evening review used to be about 6 minutes. It's 15 minutes. My calls to my sponsor for 10 steps. My God, I'm fielding stuff like crazy right now. You know, some people don't even sponsor. That's a step that's become optional. Talking about the pet peeves. We could have a meeting on pet peeves and we'd all walk away going, well, that felt good. Got that off my chest, you know. But the truth is I could be somebody's pet peeve. Katie, you know, she's way too much about the AA Big Book. I get it. We are a group of people that get along, that mix, that shouldn't mix. But we do it because our life depends on it. And God, it says we are to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So these pet peeves, trust me, I've written inventory on them so that I don't snub that guy out of my life. But I got to ask God, what is my role here, God? Am I supposed to, you know, meet him for coffee? But, you know, and then I wait for the answer.
You said a lot of interesting things. One that kind of made my ears perk up, and maybe there's a little more to discuss in here regarding sponsorship versus life coaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that God takes up a ton of slack, right? So if somebody's out there giving it their best effort, then God will take up a ton of slack. Marty and I, when I found Marty was a dear friend of mine. She's always had about 4 years less than me. And I was in real trouble. I'm talking, you know, I'm a homicidal gal. I'm not a suicidal gal. I'm thinking about taking my own life. It's a big deal for me. And when I called Marty, and she was my friend, and God clearly told me three times to ask her to be my sponsor. I'm like, no, I'm not going to. I'm not doing it. She's my friend. And I didn't want her to have that power, if you know what I mean. So I ended up saying, yeah, she said, I said, okay, I'll do it. I asked her, we agreed that our friendship would then have to have a separation, because I don't know about you guys, but if you get too close to your sponsor, all of a sudden they don't like the boy you're dating. They don't like the car you're driving. They don't like what you're dressing at AA meeting. Gets very muddy. I lose my perspective. And Marty was in untreated alcoholism. And she knew that I was going to die if she didn't help me. And she's smart as a whip. Her dad was a rocket scientist at NASA. She's just smart. So she could read the textbook and take me through the text. It's unbelievable. And let me tell you something. We still can't believe it. I'm at 17 years sober when this is happening. And Marty and I still sit down and laugh our ass off because, my God, she didn't even know what she was doing. And she did it. And when we got to the other side of it, it was remarkable. And she's an amazing woman. So God took up all that slack, woke us both up. And now we're sergeants on the firing line. It's really cool.
We got to have Marty like 3 weeks ago.
You really?
Yeah, yeah.
She's great.
It was awesome.
I always say we got to have a little moment of silence for Marty because she sponsors me.
she mentioned you once or twice.
Yeah.
You know, since you were kind enough to honor the time and everything, but it seemed like you had something more to say about the 10th step.
Oh my gosh, thank you for that.
Yes,
ma'am. You guys will give me the privilege of sharing a 10th step with you. Okay. So this is what a 10th step looked like. And because I think a lot of people don't understand what we're talking about when we say do a 10th step. They're thinking that I've already stepped on the toes of my fellows. Well, Joe, my husband, was a very sick man. We had a lot of doctor's appointments, right? And I end up, Charlie Parker was my best friend for 20 years, like a brother to me. There was no sexual energy either of us had. A lot of people don't believe that, but I'm telling you, I love Joe Gordon. I wasn't looking for anybody. I didn't flirt with boys. I had this level of part of my personality and my old ideas. And so I end up kissing my best friend. Oh, after Joe died, it was just crazy. And I mean, Charlie's like, I go in for the kiss. He's like, whoa, 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 Katie, what are you doing? I'm not going to screw up a 20-year friendship because you're losing your mind. And I thought, oh, okay, well, now I'm insulted, I'm embarrassed, you name it. I'm walking out of the house, and he goes, whoa, hold on. So I come back in, and we clearly got past this, okay? But my husband, Joe, and Charlie are two very different men. In our relationship, I did everything with Joe and I. I was raising kids, I drove, I paid the bills, I did this, because we were running a tight ship. Most women get what I'm saying, and most men get it. Well, with Charlie, he doesn't play that way. Charlie does everything. He cleans, he cooks, he grocery shops, he does everything. Most people would say, well, where's the problem? In fact, I didn't have a role. I have certainly gotten comfortable. But it took a long time because I'd lost my role. So I'm fighting, right? You scare me, hurt, threaten, or interfere with anything of mine, even if it looks to the good. And I'm going to take a step forward. I'm that girl that when I get scared, I take a step forward. So I would go into the doctor's office with a notepad with Joe because he just couldn't get it. And I'd ask questions and they'd ask me the questions and I'd tell them, well, Charlie gets sick. And we go into a doctor's office. Now, you see, I'm carrying these old ideas in there. Well, come to find out, Charlie's got a little spot on his throat. Looks like it's throat. It might be throat cancer. They do all this surgery. Come to find out, he's one dysplasia away from throat cancer. Throat cancer seems to be a very slow growing cancer. So we have to go every 3 months down to San Antonio. He's got to get his throat scoped. It's an in-office procedure, and we make a day of it. Charlie and I spend a ton of time together. We like that in our marriage. So we get up at 6 a.m., we drive 70 miles, we go eat at our favorite restaurant, then we come on the way home, we stop at the outlet mall, and that's just what we do. Well, we've been doing this now for 8 years. Right. And my sponsor knows we're going to do it because she knows I can get a little edgy at these situations. And so we go in there one day and it's early and we've made good friends with the doctor. I love Dr. Simpson to death. And he says, so Charlie and I walk in there and Charlie's the kind of guy who he walks in a doctor's office. He's like, hey, Mary. Hey, Jane. How's it going? And oh boy. So we sit down and the nurse is asking him the questions. Now, any of you guys know this is time sensitive, right? You need to answer the question. He's got to go. The doctor's got to come in. It's about a 15-minute deal and we're done. And so Charlie, you know, she says, Charlie, do you use much nose spray? And he goes, no, I don't use nose spray. Well, he uses it about every 10 minutes. It's around the house like cheater glasses, Afrin everywhere. She says, when you get up in the morning, do you clear your throat much? Oh my God. He's like, and he goes, nope. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God. And he doesn't like me to talk. See, I'm sitting there. Okay, now this is where the 10th step comes in. And I am getting angrier and angrier. And all of a sudden she walks out and I look at him and I go, you are a big fat liar, Charlie Parker. And I mean to tell you, unlike Charlie, he came out of that chair like the Incredible Hulk, you know, and just get it. And I thought, oh, I have had it. And I grab my stuff and I get ready to walk out and I've got those uncontrollable tears. You ladies know what I'm talking about, that I can't shut it off and I'm pissed. And the doctor, Dr. Simpson's walking in while I'm going out and Dr. Simpson goes, whoa, Katie. He goes, are you okay? I'm like, no. And I go out into the lobby because he's not about to stop me. And I'm sitting in the lobby and I am losing it. But it's this kind of cry where you're holding a piece of paper. Right, I'm so angry and I'm crying. Now my sponsor knows I'm there. Why? Because I told her our appointment is on this Wednesday, Marty, just FYI. Well, she works in big high criminal court. She's always in court. So she can't stop court and pick up my call. I'm not a fan of typing a 10 step, but if it has to be, it has to be. So this is a typed one and I've saved it to read to you guys. It says, Marty, I need a new toolkit for a sick husband. We're at the doctor's office and I just left the room. I can't stop crying. I must sit there and be submissive. I can't do that. He doesn't give him enough information. Now, if you've listened to enough inventory, you just heard my old idea. I must sit there and be submissive. See, I'm scared to death that Charlie's going to take my voice and I'm going to be submissive. Now, I know you're going, oh, like that's ever going to happen. To you, to me, I absolutely think I've got the gun to my head. Don't you say a word, lady. That's how it feels. Marty immediately types back, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry. It must be so painful," because that's what she does. She goes like this, and then she just knocks you in the side of the head when you're not looking. Says, "I'm sure he's scared, maybe even terrified. None of this is about you. How can you be helpful? Are you in that doctor's office treating him like he knows nothing? That you are the doctor police? Are you coming off when you're giving information to the doctors as smugly superior?" Well, let me tell you something. I text back, "Yes," and I am not crying or anything. She has just flipped the scales. And then she tells, she's not done. "Stepping on his toes, are you? Well, if not you, who? All cloaked in a good motive. You have all the tools, hon. Just use them. I know hospitals and doctors are some traumatic stuff for you, and you go on super high alert. This is a new day." And that took about 4 minutes. Charlie comes walking out. His appointment's not over. He comes walking out and he says, "Honey, please come back in there." And let me tell you, had I not done that 10 step, I'd have done this. I can kiss my foot, man. I'm not going back in there. And instead I go back in, I hug him, I go back in. And when we're sitting there, the doctor goes like this, "Katie, you okay? You okay?" Like, "Dr. Simpson, I'm okay. But I'll take it one step further. When we stopped by the outlet mall, I called my son, and it made me realize I've done that to my son. I've been this really tough, take care of your health. You know, you don't drink enough water." And I told Sam, I said, "Sam, I've just really been awakened to how I try to really push my will on y'all's health. And it's not good at all." And Sam laughed and he goes, "Oh, Mom, I actually like it." And I thought, oh, well, how sweet is that? You know, he's 31 and my oldest daughter's 41. And I thought, okay, I did my work there. But you see what a 10th step can do. I couldn't come to that with just prayer. I couldn't stop the crying. And it's a 10th step that I think really gives you, it's that third step. That third step, I think, is deeply misunderstood. Oh, and by the way, I put, I think I have my email address on, if you pin my picture on your computer, and my email address is there. And if the language I speak in AA is the language of the heart for you, and you want one of our workshops, I'll be happy. You just shoot me an email that says, "Send me all your stuff," and I can, or I can send it to you, David, and listen to these CDs, see if they wake you up. Mark Houston woke us up like nobody's business. And so it helps you understand the text, because I just don't think everybody understands the text. So that's a 10th step. Thank you for asking me that.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I just pinned it and it says gogirl@texas.net.
That's my email.
Katie, how do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection?
Well, let me tell you, like I said, these times are tough. Wow. I mean, it is difficult for me to, I normally go down to the hike and bike trail. It's a place I find a lot of serenity, and I exercise 3 times a week down there. I've been doing it for 25 years. And now I'm just looking at people going, "What do you think? What do you think?" I even considered throat punching a guy that rode past me on a bicycle. He rode too close to me. And I thought, "Dude, you come back by, I'm going to give you one of those." So we are all, and I'm telling you, I really do. I mean, I hope you judge your own program. I do a darn good program. And so I am a huge fan of understanding the disciplines of 10 and 11. And they are deep. They are deep, deep, deep. And once again, you can have a spiritual path. You can read the Bible. You can read the Quran. You can read all these things, and they're fabulous. I mean, they are great guides for many of us. But you've got to have the directions to the disciplines for staying unblocked. We alcoholics get blocked. Why? Because we are extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. So if you're sitting there going, "I just don't agree with her," well, then there it is. Then you usually don't think so. I mean, the ego's trying, the world and its people, remember that line, are trying to, you know, they dominate us, they're trying to kill us. Our life is threatened in the book. It's a fatal illness. And yet, I didn't write inventory for 15 years. I write inventory a lot. I write a lot of inventory. Lots of it's in my evening review, which is between me and God. And if you're married, oh my God, you know, I hope you're writing inventory. I always like to say Charlie makes my evening review every night because Charlie doesn't have a problem. Okay. I have the problem. He's just fine, but I have a problem. So it's really the disciplines of 10 and 11, but it's understanding what the directions mean.
We are at the close of the meeting, but I'm going to sneak in just one more question. If you could do maybe a minute or two on what being a member of a home group has done for you.
Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, my home group, I love it. Our group Conscience has about 50 people at it, which has never been my experience much with group Conscience. I'm there helping. I talk to people. I think having a home group and being a part of group Conscience is crucial. I think being a part of a home group member also means that when you walk into a meeting, you don't beeline it to your girlfriend. You find a face that you don't recognize, you know, go up to that person. Hey, are you new? I mean, there are so many things. I really believe that God has orchestrated every minute, right? This meeting now has 31 people right now that are supposed to have stayed to this moment. Do you believe that in life? And being a part of your home group is crucial. You know, it's just it's an asset of recovery, being a part of service. Now in the service structure, not everybody's cut out for that. You know, rock on if that's floats your boat. But I think you can make the coffee, set up the chairs, be the greeter at the door, answer the emails, answer the phone. There's so many things in service that you can do. So I'm a huge fan of having a home group, not several home groups, not having two sponsors. You need one sponsor and one home group.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Everybody will have an opportunity after the Lord's Prayer to thank Katie one more time. And let's see, could I get one of our home group members to read a vision for you, please?
I can do it, David.
Thank you.
A vision for you, big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come for you if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. I'd like to thank everybody for an amazing meeting. Thank Larry for wrangling the questions. People can unmute, but let's virtually circle up and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Woohoo! Katie, that was amazing. We need to do we got to do a 4-hour Katie Parker workshop.
Oh, you're sweet. I tell you, you are somebody. When you called me, you know, I wasn't doing any more Zoom meetings. Our meeting had started coming back, and it was something about your personality that I just fell in love with. And I thought, oh, dude, I'll do it for you.
I
love that.
Thank you, Katie.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a real honor, guys. Real honor.
Thank you. That was awesome.
I was told to tell you, Jack O said hello. I was told to tell you Jack O said hi.
Jack O.
From Jack California. O
from Cali.
Oh.
He's been going to a noon meeting locally on Zoom. Yeah. And he said, tell you hi.
Oh, that's very sweet. Love him.
Hey, Katie, in your years of experience, did you ever have to give a newcomer KO serve?
A newcomer what?
You have to give him KO serve.
Oh, no. I've never been. I've been on one.